Weapons of Mass Mobilization. A quiet couple in Berkeley got sick of being ignored by the system, so they built a new one. How MoveOn changed the face of fundraising, brought P2P to political advertising, and reinvented grassroots activism. The escalation of MoveOn's air war. First to arrive at the Apollo Theater on this warm spring night are boldly dressed young people who have paid $100 apiece for the cheapest seats. Soon the balconies are filled, and limousines begin to release the biggest donors, friends of the Democratic Party, who have paid $1,000 or more to rub elbows with John Mellencamp and Wyclef Jean, with Edie Falco of The Sopranos, and Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, and of course with Bill Clinton, formerly of the White House. By 8 p.m., the famous Harlem Theater is full. Clinton is the biggest celebrity here tonight, but the most enthusiastic greeting goes to two rather awkward activists from Berkeley, California. They take the podium as the crowd claps on and on. "I'm here in the Apollo Theater, for Pete's sake," says Joan Blades, a co-founder of MoveOn.org. Her halting voice and self-conscious demeanor make an island of negative charisma on stage. Next to her stands her husband and business partner, Wes Boyd, tall and pale, and equally incapable of fiery words. Although Boyd and Blades are at a hot political rally, they spend this spotlight moment reading aloud from a book MoveOn has recently published called 50 Ways to Love Your Country. This is very boring, and a few minutes later they exit, accompanied by another burst of passionate applause. Barely 6 years old, MoveOn has become one of the most revered activist groups in America, supporting Democratic political candidates with tens of millions of dollars in advertising, as well as countless hours of telephone and door-to-door fieldwork. So different, unpracticed, and uncompelling are its founders that Republicans have been provoked into speculating that the group is merely a false front for other powers acting behind the scenes. This theory, while comforting to MoveOn's adversaries, is untrue. In fact, MoveOn owes its popularity neither to the aura of Wes Boyd and Joan Blades, nor to any other familiar, conventional source. A new kind of enthusiasm fuels MoveOn, whose supporters recruit each other via email and local events, respond eagerly to telephone surveys and web questionnaires, and participate in wide-ranging discussions of tactics and priorities. Boyd and Blades aim to enhance these complex loops of communication among members. In the place of charisma, they favor quantitative research, careful experiment, and technological innovation. Behind their activism is the notion of popular rationality, the premise, or perhaps the hope, that wise decisions can emerge from the interactions of large groups. By capturing, reflecting, and amplifying collective opinion, they are trying to change the nature of politics. In 1997, Boyd and Blades sold their software company, Berkeley Systems, famous for its flying toaster screensavers and its trivia game You Don't Know Jack, for a reported $14 million. A year later came the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, which struck them as an absurd waste of public money and time. "Washington was just in this bubble of non-reality," says Blades. One night during the run-up to Clinton's impeachment, Boyd and Blades were at a Chinese restaurant for dinner. They were griping about politics, this being Berkeley. They overheard a nearby couple having the same conversation. A few days later, they emailed a petition to 100 or so friends calling on Congress to censure Clinton and MoveOn. Within a week, it had 100,000 signers. Within a month, more than 300,000. Although the email petition spread, its effect on Congress was imperceptible. Boyd and Blades were newcomers to politics. Upset at being ignored, they used a list of email addresses to arrange for supporters to make personal visits to congressional field offices around the country. In the fall of 1998, MoveOn members visited more than 400 of the 435 delegations, repeating the message of the MoveOn petition. These meetings also had no effect. Clinton was impeached. Boyd and Blades persisted, using their email list, which now had 300,000 names, to organize against the re-election of impeachment leaders in the 1998 midterm elections. Once again, the results were disappointing. Of the 30 candidates MoveOn opposed, nearly all were re-elected. MoveOn seemed to be on its way to becoming just another small, unfocused grassroots group, albeit with some interesting organizing tactics. Boyd and Blade set up a website inviting new subscribers, whom they call members, although there are no dues, and they built a system to stay in close touch with supporters online and through peer-to-peer telephone surveys. MoveOn protested the debacle of the 2000 presidential election and soon turned the membership's attention to environmental and civil liberties issues. But then came the Iraq War. As the Bush administration made its case for an invasion of Iraq, Boyd and Blades decided to publish an ad in the New York Times. An email went out to the MoveOn list. In 24 hours, they hit their goal of $70,000. In 3 days, they raised more than $400,000. By 2003, opposition to the war was merging with the interest in the presidential campaign, and the MoveOn list ballooned to some 2.3 million names. Response rates continue to be startlingly high. More than 10% of email recipients have given cash to at least one MoveOn campaign. With an average contribution of $50, Boyd and Blades can now raise millions with a few keystrokes, and they're on track to pump more than $40 million into this year's elections. From a flash campaign focused on opposing Clinton's impeachment, MoveOn has evolved into an ongoing political experiment. But the group is burdened by a double identity. On one hand, it is a Democratic juggernaut, with large supplies of cash and an ability to pour much of it into the campaign unhindered by the restrictions on political parties. On the other hand, MoveOn is an enormous social network, powered by web discussions and email petitions forwarded from friend to friend. Social networks grow through openness and moderation. But American elections call for tactics that anger, motivate, and polarize. Howard Dean's campaign had a similar split. It was both an online community and a quest for electoral victory. The link between these two halves of the Dean movement was somewhat primitive. The community supplied lots of cash, and much of that cash went to television ads. This did not turn out to be a happy relationship, and in the end both systems failed. Dean lost the primary, and his political community dissolved. MoveOn has already gone far beyond the Dean dynamics. But the challenge remains, how does a large collection of citizens influence a great national campaign, without succumbing to a fatal dependence on a small cadre of professionals? Geek activists naturally expect a good part of the answer to come from technology. The people are rational, and can be empowered. They just need better tools. Political junkies talk about the air war, and the ground war. The air war is the broadcast component of a campaign, consisting mainly of 30-second television ads. The ground war is the fieldwork component, with door-to-door canvassing and phone banks. The most celebrated innovation so far by MoveOn came in the air war. Last fall, the entire membership received an email invitation to submit a 30-second, anti-Bush commercial with a plan to broadcast the winning ad during the Super Bowl. More than 1,500 entries were posted on MoveOn's website. Members voted for the finalists and pledged enough money to buy a $2 million 30-second spot. A feedback algorithm made sure that the more popular ads were seen by more web visitors, thus making a quick distinction between winners and losers. The ad that triumphed, called Child's Pay, made by an American advertising executive living in Denmark, shows scenes of young children as dishwashers, laundry folders, and trash collectors, with a half-jaunty, half-melancholy bluegrass track, and a tagline that reads, "Guess who's going to pay off President Bush's $1 trillion deficit?" Citing a policy against issue advertising. CBS refused to air the spot, but MoveOn bought time for it on local stations in swing states during the spring. Nothing like the spot had ever been tried. For the first time, the most advanced campaign weaponry, the 30-second attack, was put directly into the hands of the activist base. This contradicted an axiom of effective political communication, the beliefs of core supporters must be carefully trimmed for mainstream acceptance. If the MoveOn membership could be trusted to produce and select an effective message, two good conclusions followed. First, Move On was a movement with wide appeal, whose ideas would be embraced in the wider world. Second, Move On could campaign energetically in the air war, without simply handing cash to the political pros. While Child's Pay was running in the swing states, other innovative tools were being deployed on the ground. Eli Parisa is director of the Move On PAC. He joined Boyd and Blades at Move On in 2001, when he was 20 years old, bringing a long email list that he generated with his own online petition against the war. Parisa, who works from his New York apartment, recently raised $750,000 in one day by organizing a nationwide bake sale. Only a small fraction of Move On's membership will travel to a swing state this fall. So Parisa is building a virtual phone bank that distributes essential get-out-the-vote labor to tens of thousands of volunteers across the country. The first tests came in May, when volunteers downloaded cold call scripts and lists of phone numbers, brought their cell phones to parks and living rooms, and contacted people to make sure their voter registration was current. Move On made more than 300,000 calls that afternoon. Phone banks are usually held in open offices or union halls, with careful monitoring and well-honed pitches. Parisa has no qualms about turning over this part of the groundwork to unsupervised volunteers. We want to challenge the mental block, the structural dogma, that only pros can make calls, he says. The very point of Move On, Parisa explains, is to increase communication among real citizens. His focus is not on monitoring or controlling the conversations, but on making them even more convenient and casual. Parisa is building the capacity to reach 800,000 people a day, starting in late October. Volunteers will dial an 800 number, enter an Idaho, and hear a tape of the calling guide, customized to reflect the message and strategy of the day. An auto-dialer will connect them to a potential voter within a few seconds. When the call is completed, but before hanging up, they can enter data via their telephone keypad. Was the correct person reached? Was his or her registration current? Then, if the volunteer has time, he or she can go down the list. This lets Move On supporters take advantage of any free moment to influence the election. People can't believe it, Parisa says. There is a feeling that you have to tie people's shoes for them. But in fact, politics does not require any special skill aside from those required in any social enterprise. Amid the vicious back and forth of the presidential campaign, Boyd and Blades cling to an identity as moderates and political skeptics, whose main cause is civic engagement. But Move On's battle to define itself as a moderate, authentically up from the grassroots movement has not been going well. Off the record, says one Republican campaign operative I ask about Move On, they say they have all these members, but have they ever released a list of names? Use some skepticism. A lot of their money comes from George Soros. A little more than a year ago, Soros convened a meeting in Southampton, Long Island, inviting a number of Democratic groups waging campaigns against Bush. Nobody from Move On was there. But later, in a face-to-face conversation with Boyd, Soros pledged $2.5 million in matching funds. Peter Lewis, chair of the insurance company Progressive Corporation, pledged another $2.5 million. Move On had raised about $29 million as of last spring, most of it from small contributions. Soros and Lewis are by far the largest individual donors, and Move On has also teamed up with other Soros-supported groups, participating in an omnibus Democratic Get Out the Vote campaign called America Coming Together. Soros is a Hungarian-born Jew, and a famous social liberal, who got rich speculating on currency markets, making him a nice candidate for certain types of conspiracy theories. Who but extremists, Republicans ask, would take millions of dollars from a man who favors full civil rights for homosexuals and is opposed to sending drug users to prison? The tactic has worked well, and Move On is now seldom mentioned in the press without a prominent reference to Soros. But for Move On, the Soros spin is a minor irritation compared to the Hitler story. Earlier this year, the anti-Bush ad contest was getting a lot of press, mostly bad. Republican operatives, poking around in the less popular directories on the MoveOn website, found two entries comparing Bush to Hitler. MoveOn removed the submissions, but they continue to live on in Republican ads, which use them as evidence that their adversaries are a coalition of wild-eyed maniacs. The story that MoveOn uses images of Hitler in its ads proved irresistible and propagated everywhere. Even Wes Boyd, who prefers to focus on the experiment's positive implications, was impressed by what happened. If you think of the culture as a big brain, you've got this sub-region that is very sensitive to CNN and Fox News, Boyd says. This group can make the culture go into epileptic seizures when there is a pulse through the news. The Soros spin and the Hitler story are evidence that there is a glitch in the interface between MoveOn social network, which imagines itself to be moderate and reasonable, and the larger political community in which it competes, where MoveOn has been tagged as extremist. But this is not simply, or even mainly, the product of Republican countertactics. It is a glitch in MoveOn's basic premise of popular rationality. After all, MoveOn's purpose isn't merely to satisfy its supporters by widely trumpeting their political views. The point is also to successfully represent these views, to market them, to make them influential. Boyd and Blades are too experienced in business not to believe that marketing requires expertise. That's why Child's Pay, while a compelling example of direct participation in the air war, is one of only two member-generated ads MoveOn has broadcast. Most of MoveOn's commercials are made by experienced operatives at a left-wing advertising firm in Santa Monica, California. The firm of Zimmerman and Markman occupies a small suite of offices in a four-story building a few blocks from the beach. Bill Zimmerman, the agency's strategist, has a Ph.D. in psychology and got his start in politics registering black voters in Mississippi in 1962. He worked with Jane Fonda on anti-Vietnam War mobilization and has played a role in drug decriminalization campaigns. Pacey Markman, the agency's copywriter, has a long career in commercial advertising. He wrote the indelible slogan Miller Lite, everything you always wanted in a beer, and less. MoveOn, he says, is my penance. The assertion that MoveOn is centrist might be supported by the example of Child's Pay, but Zimmerman and Markman are traditional partisan gunslingers. The spots they produce are deeply negative, hitting again and again upon a theme of dishonesty in the Bush administration, and using a tagline that the agency chose soon after the president posed for the famous mission accomplished photos on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, "We are not being led, we're being misled." We were trying to push a more acceptable way of calling the president a liar, says Zimmerman. At the time, given his approval rating, liar would have met with too much resistance. But yes, says Markman, I am telling you that the president is a fucking liar. MoveOn buys these ads because they work. A political campaign in the real world isn't merely a competition between social networks, but rather a series of sharp, tactical engagements where arguments are boiled down into images, and the goal is to provoke an unfocused citizenry into a victorious stampede. It would be irresponsible, it would be irrational, to blind oneself to the folly of groups. This puts a contradiction into MoveOn's philosophy, a bug into their system. Ideally, MoveOn members would seek to augment their social network through debate and conversation with other rational citizens. But it is the undecided voter whose opinion will swing the election. These voters tend to be both disengaged and poorly informed. With the same cool-headedness that guides their member surveys and distributed fieldwork, MoveOn undertakes to predict in advance what sort of emotional appeals will sway people who don't read newspapers or have much historical knowledge, but watch plenty of television. Unlike many campaigns, MoveOn rarely uses focus groups, which it considers laughably subjective. Instead, Stanley Greenberg, MoveOn's research consultant, selects small cities for their demographic mix and does polling in all of them. Two communities get test ads, while the other towns function as controls. In a week or two, there is a new round of polling, and MoveOn learns which ads are most lethal. Some of the ads make me uncomfortable, admits Joan Blades. But then I ask myself, is it true? Is what this being said important? It felt harsh to say that the president lied to us, but he did. Anyway, says Markman, good advertising always makes the client uncomfortable. If you are completely comfortable, it is a sign you are just talking to yourself. MoveOn is competing increasingly in states where negative commercials play all day long. The excess of messages reduces their effectiveness, which leads all the campaigns to spend even more money on ads. And yet, despite a sense of exhaustion about television ads and cynicism about people who take them seriously, no campaign will forego an attack by air. This year, MoveOn has proven that a brilliantly managed email campaign can support these attacks with tens of millions in small political contributions. But MoveOn's goals are larger than that, and what happens when the campaign ends, and the reason for the air attack vanishes. Perhaps MoveOn, in the midst of its triumph, has already failed. The group's massive, virally spreading petitions, its decentralized fieldwork, and market-tested messages have not produced a fresh, original form of politics. Instead, they've stirred up a weird melange. But there's another way to look at it. This mix of old and new may be a sign not of failure, but of success. Marshall McLuhan believed that new media cannibalize their predecessors, writing preserve stories that have been spoken or sung. Television was visual radio. On the internet, people send each other letters. McLuhan's point is that you can't simply look at the content of a medium to judge its effects, for the content will, at first, be traditional. Instead, you have to look at the context and the way the contents are consumed. Which is more important, the medium or its contents? In the case of MoveOn, this is a testable hypothesis. If McLuhan was wrong, then MoveOn, next year, will be merely the suck-dry remnants of a gigantic fundraising list, expiring in the aftermath of the campaign. If McLuhan was right, then MoveOn will continue to evolve and grow, assimilating all the familiar forms of politics into itself, extending them, heightening their impact, and using the material of yesterday to produce tomorrow's unpredictable effects. Last fall, MoveOn put a 30-second TV spot in the hands of the rank and file, asking members to submit and later vote on ads attacking Bush. Out of 1,500-plus entries, the winner was Child's Pay, a low-key ad about the deficit that ran in local markets nationwide in early 2004. But the bulk of MoveOn's ads have been produced by Zimmerman and Markman, pros who hit low, hard, and personal.